This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Here's some of the tough questions doctors are facing regarding their role in the opioid crisis.
There is no one magic wand that you're going to wave here and the problem will disappear.
Notable pain doctor Ramson Benyamin tells GLT's Ryan Denham understanding how the opioid crisis began is the key to reversing it. Hear our conversation with former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch. The Obama appointee talks with GLT's John Norton. And get to know a special Emmy Award-winning performer and storyteller coming to the Bloomington Public Library. Laura Kennedy has the interview. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 29th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch says it's not easy to resolve the huge difference in how Americans view the police. During a stop in Bloomington Normal for the Martin Luther King Jr. Cultural Dinner at Illinois State University, Lynch told GLT's John Norton one of her top priorities was bridging the divide between police and citizens. She says that was long true before her 2 years as Attorney General.
First thing that I would say is that it's an issue that I've been working on actually since the 1990s in New York, when I worked on the Abner Louima case in Brooklyn, and saw how that case really roiled the city and just eroded the bonds of trust. But at the same time, I also saw situations where when I had police and agents working directly within a community, they were able to, on a community-by-community basis, reconnect and rebuild that trust. So when I was able to move into the Attorney General's chair, I was honored to be able to have the opportunity to bring that perspective to bear. I've always found that by going out into the field, you get the best answers to these questions. What we focused on were cities that had had a very challenged relationship with the police and often with the Department of Justice, but had really worked to bring themselves back from that. And we looked at what these six cities had in common and tried to bring those ideas to other cities, other police jurisdictions. The main issue that I still hear about is community desire for transparency and accountability on the part of the police. Is there a trust in, for example, an internal affairs system that it will fairly adjudicate a shooting or use of force? Is there the ability to understand the parameters or the guidelines that a police department is going to use to look at that? How can citizens get a view into that process so they feel that whatever the result, it's been fair? That's a very difficult question. It requires looking at police training. It requires looking at police culture. Unfortunately, what often drives people to the table is usually a tragic event. Mm-hmm. And so you also have to deal with the emotions that run high after these events.
We've had both of our towns are dealing with police civilian review boards. One has it now, the other one's working on it. One of the arguments from the police side is that the general public doesn't understand police work. Is that a fair argument?
It actually is fair.
Okay.
It is fair. Police work is very different from most other professions in this country, in the need for the type of training, the type of equipment, and frankly, the incredible amount of power that a police officer has, the discretion that they have to use, and the judgment they have to bring to bear in every second of the day almost. So it actually is a fair comment, and I've heard that a lot. But what has to follow that comment are a platform or a bridge to communications, for lack of a better phrase, to help the public understand. Several years ago, what used to be popular were what were called ride-alongs. So a local police department would invite, usually starting with elected officials, journalists, and then citizens, to literally ride along with them and see what a police officer's day was like. Los Angeles is doing that electronically. You can ride along. You can connect with an officer via the department's Facebook page and ride along with that officer and actually see what they encounter. A lot of police departments are using body cameras to put video up of a typical day in the life of a police officer. So that's helpful. What I've also found helpful is to involve the community in police training. When the police academy structures a program that has at least some way to bring community leaders in to see what type of training is going on and to provide input into that, not to take it over, because that's not their training, but to raise their questions and concerns and say to the trainers, how are you going to handle a situation where a family member has to call the police because an emotionally disturbed person is someone that they can't control, and to get those answers early on in the process.
Well, let's talk about the advent of cell phones over the last few years. This has really been a game changer, you know, and can even give the impression things are worse than they have been. Are they better or worse now? And how do cell phones change the conversation?
The visual makes it real to people who really did not understand the impact of an officer-involved shooting. And this is members of the community who maybe have been sympathetic, but just often did not understand what members, people particularly in the minority community, were saying when they talked about the level of frustration and fear and concern that these incidents raise. It also, these viral videos also have shown people the depth of the problem. You're right, police shootings have always occurred. I mean, police officers have to use their guns in many situations. The number of officer-involved shootings of civilians has stayed roughly even for the past 2 or 3 years. It's around the high 900s to 1,000. But this visibility into these actions has raised questions and concerns, but it's also given people an idea of how fast these incidents occur on the one hand, and sometimes what goes into them. My view is that this is really akin to the time in the civil rights movement when the police cameras showed the level of violence being displayed and being aimed at kids and people marching in the streets of the South. And people at that point who before had said, sounds like a good idea, but I'm not really sure it's my issue, finally said, now I get it. Now I understand what people are talking about. It's not a question of whether the videos are good or bad. It's what do we do with them? Do we use them as a way to open up dialogue? Do we use them as a way to talk about how body cameras are different from cell phones with videos? And do we use them as a way to tell the story of what policing is like in America today?
Well, that is an interesting comparison between the civil rights movement and TV and today's phones with officer-civilian interactions. That means white people finally see what's going on with people of color. That's kind of what we're saying, right?
That's exactly what we're saying.
So what does that say about our society, that it takes that in order for a large part of our population to go, oh, I had no idea.
You know, I think that one of the things we have to do is really look at how diverse this population is and what that means, and understand that sometimes when people don't get it, sometimes they're actively opposed to a particular viewpoint, but sometimes it's just not part of their experience. You know, Martin Luther King called it the other America, and using the civil rights movement to awaken most, at the time, mostly white Americans' views to what life was like for blacks in the South and also in the North, as we know we came to Illinois as well. The viral videos have done similar things to that. And so we've now been able to have a much broader discussion about law enforcement accountability. We have police officers who are actively involved in working on these issues, working on, for example, de-escalation training. I was able to visit some incredibly talented police departments as Attorney General who are working on these issues, who know that they did not want to be the next Ferguson, Missouri. They didn't want to be the next Baltimore. And they looked at their community. And often they came to the Department of Justice and said, what resources do you have that can help us? And often what we were able to do was connect them with other departments that were thinking through these same issues. We also sometimes, you know, as you know, had to take action to hold police departments accountable. Our pattern and practice activity, for example, was one way in which we did that.
Okay, this is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton, speaking with former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, who served in the Obama administration for the past couple of years of his tenure. We're speaking ahead of the Martin Luther King Jr. Cultural Dinner, for which Loretta Lynch is the keynote speaker. Let's talk about the Trump administration. And like any administration, priorities change when administrations change. And it does with the police community relations. And the Trump administration is sending basically this conversation back to the local level, states and cities to deal with. Do you feel that there has been or is enough momentum that has happened over the past few years that these conversations will continue at the local level?
I feel that it is, just from talking to people in the field, and I certainly hope that it is. We spent a lot of time in the last administration trying to empower communities and law enforcement to both have a dialogue about how to improve relationship, but also to put in place real changes that were evidence-based, that had been proven to have worked in other jurisdictions. I also know, from talking to a lot of police chiefs across the country, as I mentioned before, they don't want to be the next Ferguson. They don't want to be the next Baltimore. No police chief wants to wake up and have to explain to a family why their child is no longer living because of an encounter with an officer. That's not what they want. They want to protect the communities that they serve, and they want the tools and resources to do that. Community members also are getting more involved. You know, they are essentially engaging one-on-one with police officers. You mentioned a civilian review board in one of the Twin Cities here. Those can be very effective. But what I would say is that those boards have to constantly be thinking about ways to keep their work fresh, to keep it relevant, and to keep it connected, particularly with young people, people who aren't necessarily in the workforce or typically wouldn't engage with authority figures, will tell you what's going on in terms of their view of law enforcement.
You also need buy-in from the police department as well.
Absolutely.
And we talked with the police chief of Lincoln, Nebraska last year. They've been doing community policing seriously for 45 mm-hmm. years. And it was 9 months into his job at the time we talked to him, and he was coming from the state patrol, and he was a little dubious about mm-hmm. community policing and about the review board. And when we talked to him 9 months later, he said, "I'm a total believer." He mm-hmm. said, "It is a need. It's not a want anymore." So you need that buy-in.
You do.
How do you get that buy-in if people don't want to buy in?
You know, what we found is that when it comes to police leadership, you do have individuals who are not familiar with how effective community policing can be. And when we encountered that at the Department of Justice, hopefully we would encounter it before there was an incident that brought us in. We would encounter it through discussion and dialogue. But often you encounter that when something has happened. One of the things that we do is try and make other police chiefs available to them who do have a positive experience with community policing. We worked a lot through the community-oriented policing services, or the COPS office, to connect local law enforcement leaders together. It's great if someone from Washington comes out and can provide resources and funding for community policing, and that's wonderful. And it's great if either the Attorney General or someone else connected with the department can talk about the importance of community policing. It's key that their peers and colleagues share the information. And so when you connect a police chief with one of his colleagues, you can really have an honest dialogue and talk about those benefits.
I want to ask you about guns. Americans kill each other more than any other Western advanced country, and police killing civilians is part of that. The commonality seems to be guns. When you were Attorney General, was that part of the conversation when you would talk with police and civilians and civil rights groups about community policing and about how to make things better?
Certainly, on a community-by-community basis, you would know what the main issues were. And you're right. In most police shootings, a lot of them involve emotionally disturbed people, but a lot of them involve individuals who have firearms, and the police are encountering those people.
Well, if I could, I mean, it's got to make a police officer more jittery, or whatever term you want to use, knowing that everyone might be armed, right? I mean, in other countries, that doesn't happen. Here, you don't know who's armed anymore. That's got to have a huge effect on police officers.
It does, and it certainly is something that a lot of police departments are factoring into their training. Certainly, there are going to be times when officers have to use force. Our view was always that it needed to be proportional and calibrated to the harm that they were facing. But there are going to be times when a gun is going to escalate the situation. When it comes to civilian use of firearms against each other, that's one of the tragedies of this country. You know, I grew up in the South. I'm from North Carolina, where guns are a way of life as much as they are in many other places. And I can remember in high school, every year, one of my classmates would lose their lives because they found a firearm and they were playing with it. So one of the things we focused on in the last administration was trying to enact policies that dealt with firearm safety, trying to, for example, fund firearm safety regulations that would let a gun recognize its owner, the smart gun system. Because we know, or we knew, I should say, that responsible gun owners also want to be safe gun owners. And those two things are not inconsistent. And that's something that I think, frankly, has not been talked about enough. It's another type of debate that has become very polarized. And so you have a lot of discussion on the extreme sides of that issue, but not a lot of talk about what can the responsible gun owner do to also ensure gun safety. No gun owner wants their child to suffer an accident. No gun owner wants to be robbed and have that gun used against some other innocent person. And so this is an area in which I've always thought there could be a great deal of common ground.
Former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch served under the Obama administration. She spoke with GLT's John Norton about a number of topics, including policing. Lynch was the featured speaker at the annual Martin Luther King Jr. Cultural Dinner Friday night at Illinois State University. Lynch declined to answer questions about the Hillary Clinton campaign and some other issues because of ongoing investigations. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. An organization that has a particular view of the police is Black Lives Matter. President Donald Trump's administration has been in power for a year now. Black Lives Matter marked 4 years as an organization in 2017. Over the past 4 years, the group's goals have shifted. There are local chapters all over the country, including Bloomington Normal and Champaign-Urbana. IPR's Rachel Otwell talked with the Champaign-Urbana BLM leader, Evelyn Richards, who's also a professor at Parkland College.
There's a lot of pieces that, you know, kind of summarize 2017, but the Women's March was extremely significant for not only combating, you know, some of the really horrendous things that Trump has said and done toward and to women, but also it kind of highlighted the divisions among women, you know, and the racism and the classism that exists among women. So I really think the Women's March is one of the most significant things that happened in 2017. As far as Black Lives Matter, I mean, I think, you know, we celebrated 4 years in 2017. Which was really significant, you know, for a movement that that is leaderful, you know, and but doesn't have the structure that, you know, a lot of earlier movements does. But it's lasted 4 years and it's still thriving. There's over 40 chapters in the U.S., two in Canada. We're making a lot of connections in other places around the world. It's been amazing. We've really kept up the momentum, and that continues on into this year.
So already this year, President Trump has allegedly made comments that many say exemplify his racism. By now, I think we've all heard about his referring to countries like Haiti and El Salvador as being blank holes. So how do you decide, as a Black Lives Matter chapter, whether or not to react publicly to such comments?
You know, we're not surprised that he said that, because I think his actions and other things that he said has shown that sort of sentiment before, as far as the way that he views other countries around the world, especially less wealthy countries and countries with more people of color. So I don't think it was shocking, but there was discussion about, okay, should we put a statement out? How should we respond, you know, to this? It wasn't in the way that I, you know, remember us reacting earlier on, where it was like, okay, this is, you know, we're going to have a march now. We're going to, you know, I think we've realized that we can't take to the streets and put all of our energy into every single crazy, racist, you know, sexist, xenophobic thing that the president or anyone else says. You know, there's a lot of really significant issues to face. And so we are going to put most of our energy there. But definitely, you know, make it known that we see this. We recognize what this means, and it's vitriol. And that Trump statements kind of speak to a larger cultural issue that we have with the language that's being used and how, you know, our culture is really, mainstream culture is really kind of racist, you know, and the way that anti-blackness is just kind of woven within it. Racism and sexism are problems that are kind of woven into the language that we use and the images that we use in our larger culture. So I think that's something that we need to address. And that's a big task.
Looking overall at the year ahead and where things stand now, how do you see Black Lives Matter grappling with rhetoric and policies put forth by the Trump administration?
I don't know if we as a society, or even activists or those conscious and concerned about social inequality. If we realize the magnitude of what that meant when Trump was elected president, and of course many people were startled when it actually happened because we kind of, in the back of our minds, thought that it wouldn't happen. And so to see Trump as president and really being able to kind of carry out a lot of this agenda that he laid forward on the campaign trail as far as stripping those most in need of their health care and their housing and affordable education and all those sorts of things, I mean, that's happening. And I think that makes me really sad that, you know, there's a reality there that is only going to get worse, I predict, as long as this person is president and as long as he has a group of people working with him that are also making decisions based on a very privileged, uninformed perspective. You know, I actually see a lot of hope that people have right now. I see people still organizing, resisting, coming together, waking up. I see, you know, this level of consciousness being raised, and a lot of really good things that make me very hopeful, actually, in this crazy, tumultuous time. I feel a lot of hope and a lot of energy. And I really think that there's going to be some progress made in 2018.
Evelyn Reynolds heads the Champaign-Urbana chapter of Black Lives Matter. She spoke with IPR's Rachel Otwell on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up on Sound Ideas, a one-on-one with an Emmy Award-winning storyteller coming to the Bloomington Public Library. Laura Kennedy has the interview. I'm Mike McCurdy. The overprescription of opiate painkillers is widely considered one of the drivers of the current opioid epidemic. That puts McLean County doctors on the front lines of a problem that's being prescribed all sorts of solutions from policymakers and the media. What do the doctors themselves think should be done? GLT's Ryan Denham starts by asking Dr. Ramson Benyamin, a well-regarded pain doctor practicing in Bloomington Normal.
There is no one magic wand that you're going to wave here and the problem will disappear. This is a problem that gradually has grown, and there's multiple aspects to it.
Benyamin is president of the Millennium Pain Center, which has 7 locations around Illinois, including 1 in Bloomington. He's also a clinical assistant professor of surgery at the U of I College of Medicine. Benyamin says the medical community has been talking about opioid abuse for over a decade.
Unfortunately, the politicians and news media are now latecomers to this problem. And the problem has expanded beyond prescription opioids. And as you know, some of the numbers that are thrown out in front of the public, they don't actually represent only prescription opioids. It's a mixed bag, and by majority, I mean two-thirds of the deaths that are happening with opioids are street drugs like heroin and synthetic fentanyl. But for the coroner and the pathologist, it's very difficult to differentiate the cause of death when it comes to person who has prescription opioids and street drugs and benzodiazepines in their system. So they call it opioid overdose.
And as you say, if two-thirds of overdose deaths are from street drugs, as you call them, I still think that there is a sort of a conventional wisdom or a narrative out there that is that the practice of over-prescribing prescription opioids has helped drive up opioid abuse.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, so do you think that is true? And
absolutely,
that's part of the problem?
We've had this problem for many years, and it's not just over-prescribing, but co-prescribing with other medications that are considered central nervous system depressants, like benzodiazepines.
medications like Xanax, Ativan, Valium. These are all medications that when mixed with opioids, they have what we call it a synergistic effect, meaning that 2 + 2 becomes 5 or 6. So they make the impact even more serious. And that's a problem that we are facing. If you look into CDC guidelines that were published in 2016, you will notice that they warn the primary care physician, which were the main target of the CDC guidelines, please do not mix, because the majority of the serious adverse events happen when you mix the opioids with benzodiazepines. So that's an area that unfortunately is less covered by the media, but it's the reality.
Benyamin says the problem can be traced back as far as 2000. That's when a key hospital accrediting group called the Joint Commission issued new standards for how hospitals treat pain.
That accreditation agency mandated the pain levels to be drawn to a lowest acceptable, and in essence, they promoted use of more opioids. And they went as far as calling pain as a fifth vital sign. So, and then the pharmaceutical companies who were making the opioids, they seized on the moment and they increased their, you look at the sales of opioids since the year 2000, they have quadrupled in the United States. I don't know if you are aware, Ryan, but we are 4.5% of the world population, but we consume 99% of all the hydrocodone supply in the world. We consume 73% of all the oxycodone supply in the world. I understand we are a compassionate nation, but you know, there's reason why we got there.
Dr. Kelly Smith is on the front lines. She's an attending physician in the emergency department at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington. Like many doctors, she was trained that pain is the fifth vital sign.
We've had this push for a long time that, you know, we need to treat a patient's pain, and in order to do that, generally we turn to opiate medications in order to try and treat it. And we've gotten to a practice where it's easier to kind of give out the pain medication and kind of move people along than to necessarily sit down and address the underlying issue of, you know, maybe this isn't necessarily chronic pain. Maybe this is chronic pain that's being exacerbated by overuse of medications.
Smith did her residency at Southern Ohio Medical Center, one of the hardest hit areas in the country for the opioid epidemic. She says she'd rarely go an entire shift without seeing at least one or two overdoses.
Physically, it looks like the person is pretty limp. They don't really have, they're not awake. If they are awake, they're usually just not making sense. They're barely making words, if any. Typically, their breaths are very shallow. It almost looks like they're not breathing at all, and sometimes they're not breathing. And then it's almost as though you have somebody who's just completely passed out on you, that no matter what you're doing, trying to move them around, they're not waking up.
I asked Smith if there's a risk of an overcorrection here, if doctors will be so alarmed by the opioid epidemic that they'll overdo it on limiting access to opiate painkillers.
I think that, you know, people are going to be more conscientious of it, but if I have someone come into my department who they genuinely need outpatient management for, you know, a fracture or a kidney stone or something like that, I'm not going to withhold pain medication just because I'm concerned about the laws that are saying, hey, you know, we're trying to limit the amount of opiates that we prescribe. If it's a legitimate reason of why I'm prescribing it, I'm not going to withhold it. Yeah. But I will definitely give it a second thought before I, of how much I'm going to prescribe and what is a reasonable amount to expect a person to take.
Things are already changing, and some of it's not voluntary. As of January 1st, a new state law requires drug prescribers like Smith to use a database containing patient prescription histories. Physicians who don't may be subject to state disciplinary action. Here's Dr. Smith.
I think that part of the reason it got so bad in Ohio was that there wasn't a lot of oversight with how much how many prescriptions could be written for how much and for how long. So I think that's one thing that has already been addressed here, and making physicians look at before they prescribe something, how often this person has had those prescriptions written. Another thing, I think that a big part of it is figuring out other ways that people who are using narcotics as for pain medication, like figuring out another way, an incentive, not necessarily an incentive, but figuring out how to get them into pain management clinics, figuring out other ways to deal with their pain rather than turning to a pill. Really, we want to treat the underlying problem, and we don't want people to chronically have to be on medication to do it. So I don't know necessarily what that means policy-wise, but that's kind of, we need to figure out the long-term how to help people pass the medication part of what is wrong with them.
Benyamin shares that three-dimensional view of the problem. He says another contributing factor is that doctors sometimes don't have a lot of options.
We have, in reality, we have shortage of effective pain medications that are non-opioids. And that's a reality. And then, at the same time, you have limitations as far as insurance companies, whether government insurance or private insurance, they all have limitations of what medications they cover. And if you look, you will find out that majority of them do not cover, they don't have good coverage for non-opioids. I'll give you an example, a real example, that we had a patient who had the state Medicaid insurance, and we're trying to get the patient an anti-inflammatory patch, okay? Less systemic side effects and safer and non-opioid. After 30 minutes being on the line, they came back to us and said, well, we don't cover that, but we cover fentanyl patch. Imagine that. So if you're looking for a solution, you have to address all these issues.
So you're sort of describing a medical approach to solving the problem, right? Before we start getting all tied up in how we're going to treat the problem, we need to better understand the diagnosis and actually make a better diagnosis of how we got here.
Correct. That's on the medical side. Now, is addiction a problem in our society? Absolutely. But we got to deal with it as an addiction problem, with a substance use disorder. There's diagnosis for this. Do we have enough resources to address addiction? Unfortunately, no. And a lot of times, most insurances don't even cover those services. So that's an area that we can improve by providing more psychological services that can address this as an addiction problem. There is a medication that can be used as an outpatient to maintain these patients so they don't get into deeper problem and treat their substance use disorder. That FDA has been pretty good in the last few years in advancing this issue and making it more available. That's one area that we can improve. And then you gotta cut the supply of these deadly heroin and synthetic fentanyl. I cannot imagine that this synthetic fentanyl is made in China and leaves China somehow and ends up in McLean County. It to me, it's unbelievable how this happens, and we cannot stop it. So there's multiple things that we can do, but we have to be careful with regulations that also, because that was one of the reasons the overprescription happened. And education of doctors. We don't have pain management as a, standardized educational activity for our medical students. That's exactly my involvement with the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. So, but we are in the early stages of that education. So education of the doctors, medical students, nursing staff, I think that will play a big role. And I would say the fact that media is drawing attention, the fact that I'm sitting here discussing this with you, I think this is a positive change.
Well, speaking of the media, I want to ask your opinion of how this issue has been covered generally in the last couple of years. And what advice would you give to reporters, editors, producers out there as they're doing stories about this issue?
to be fair and you know, provide the facts. And the facts are that, as I mentioned to you, not all these deaths are prescription opioids. But at the same time, let's not forget, we do have a problem of prescription opioid use, abuse, and misuse, and overprescription. There is no doubt. But at the same time, the majority of the deaths are happening because of the street drugs. So just cover the whole story, not just be selective to fit certain agenda.
That's Dr. Ramsen Binyamin, president of the Millennium Pain Center and a professor at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. Joining him today was Dr. Kelly Smith, an attending physician in the emergency department at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center. I'm Ryan Denham.
Opioid-related deaths more than doubled in McLean County in 2017, climbing to 34 from just 15 the year prior. Seven others died in 2017 from overdoses involving other types of drugs. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. The Governor Bruce Rauner administration is unable to account for a large amount of Medicaid money. That's the $7 billion question of the week on the Illinois Politics Roundtable, comprised of Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, moderator Sean Crawford, and Kristen Schorsch, a health reporter for Crane's Chicago Business. Where did the money go? Schorsch says the $7 billion is not exactly chump change.
Right. That represents about half of the spending in the Medicaid program. So this audit essentially questions the administration's ability to monitor private insurers who are increasingly overseeing the care of a large portion of Medicaid recipients. It's called managed care. It's a program where the governor actually just recently overhauled. And at some point, there's going to be at least 80% of people on Medicaid in this program. And so there's been a lot of questions about how private insurers are spending money. And so lawmakers last year essentially got approval to have an audit done. So the Illinois Auditor General's Office analyzed 2016 information when there were 12 insurers in this program, largely for-profit carriers. And one of the big things that he unraveled was that the state failed to properly monitor the $7.11 billion that flow to and from these private insurance companies.
Now, we don't expect that this money is just sitting someplace in a shoebox necessarily, that a lot of this money was likely spent, but we just don't know exactly how it was spent, or what are we looking at?
Right. We don't know how it was spent. So, for example, one of the big things that the Auditor General's Office found was that the claims that insurers pay to doctors and hospitals, so when a doctor sees you as a patient, they bill the insurance company to get paid back. We don't have information on that. We don't know how much money they're spending on coordinating the care of Medicaid recipients, which is the goal of managed care, is for private insurance companies to do a better job than the state in terms of improving the health of Medicaid recipients and saving the state money. So if we don't know how much they're actually spending on coordinating care, how do we know that that's actually being efficient? Those are some of the big things. Also, the state hasn't reconciled about $14 billion in payments to the insurer since 2012. So we don't know if the state overpaid these insurance companies and say these insurance companies owe the state money. We don't know that.
One of the things that I found interesting in the audit, and which you mentioned in the story that you did, apparently, the way managed care works, let's say if I'm in a managed care program, the insurer gets paid a certain amount of dollars per month, and if I have no medical costs, that's all profit for the insurer, minus administrative costs. Mm-hmm. If I have costs that are in excess of what they're paid, then they have to eat it. So the state knows, or is supposed to know, exactly how much is going to be spent, rather than I go to the doctor, the state gets billed. If I go 12 times, the state gets billed 12 times, that kind of thing. But what I found kind of mystifying or distressing, apparently for tens of thousands of people, the state was paying twice.
Right. There were a certain amount, I think it was about 300 people or so, They were billed twice. It was almost $600,000. There were duplicate payments made to the insurance companies.
And so we should be entitled to recover those, right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the recommendations from the audit, is that the state recoup that. It sounds like a lot of this has to do with technology and just the financial accounting systems on both the state's end and the insurance company's end. So one of the recommendations is actually to go to the insurance companies and say, hey, look, let us see your financial data systems, your computer systems. And we want to test the accuracy of those and the completeness of the data to make sure that everything is on par.
You know, somebody I talked to about this person is a Democrat. They're actually supportive of the concept of going to this managed care because they do believe it'll, you know, help preserve the program, save money in the long run. But the question this person raised is, are these insurance companies, we don't know if they could be acting like the bad old days in the 1990s when HMOs were out there, and the knock on them was that people were paying their insurance premiums, and so you paid for your health insurance, but you could never actually get health care because you would just be denied, or there'd have be so many restrictions. Or they'd, you know, sort of work to rule and say, well, you didn't get pre-approval for this, so we're not going to cover it. And, you know, we just don't know if that's what's going on, but that's certainly the fear. And, you know, the people who are paying for the service now, we're talking about tax money from the state of Illinois.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fair point. I will point out that there was a consultant's report that came out around December that actually said that he looked at a bunch of the insurance companies in Medicaid managed care and found that they were operating collectively at a loss. And so he actually argued that they should get paid more, that they should have higher reimbursement rates, because otherwise insurance companies might say, you know what, because most of us are for profit and we're not making enough, we might just leave this program. And then the state of Illinois potentially has to scramble and then spread more people out to other insurance companies.
What did the Rauner administration, whenever they get these audit findings, they can respond to those. What's been their response so far?
Their response was that they are monitoring administrative costs, that they actually have put in place processes to remove those duplicate clients so that they are not paying twice or more than that, and to recoup overpayments from previous years. And so they said that they've done that already, and that they also said that they are going to provide clear instructions to these insurance companies to make sure that, because one of the criticisms in the audit was that regarding denied claims. So a lot of doctors and hospitals have complained about managed care because they say it's a big administrative headache. One of the big things is that insurance companies deny a lot of claims. And so the audit found that that was another thing that wasn't being kept track of, because the state should actually make sure that that those claims appropriately are denied. And so another instruction is that we need to make sure that we have the proper reporting of denied claims to the state.
When we look at the Medicaid program and what could lie ahead for that, it's not the only change that some people want to see, including both at the federal and even at the state level. Are there other changes that could be coming down the line for Medicaid recipients?
Well, I know one of the big things that's being talked about across the country is this idea of implementing work requirements for people on Medicaid. During a news conference earlier this month, Governor Rauner did say he supports work requirements for people who can hold down jobs. In other words, people who don't have a disability or are not caring for a sick parent. But that he said there aren't enough jobs in Illinois. And so right now it's not a priority for his administration. But there are neighboring states that are looking into this. So Kentucky, they've received federal approval to impose a work requirement. Nine other states at least have submitted proposals to do so, including Indiana and Wisconsin. I will say that just in terms of across the country, keep in mind that most people on Medicaid do have a full or a part-time job. It's 6 in 10 people who are not elderly. So 60% of people have a job that are on Medicaid, and that's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, which tracks this kind of information. Another thing that is going to come up that's a really big deal in the Medicaid space, especially for hospitals, is what's called the Hospital Assessment Program. It's going under a major redesign. It's essentially nearly all hospitals in the state contribute to a pool of money. Illinois takes that to the federal government to get it matched. This program generates about $3.5 billion for the state Medicaid program. It's a huge deal. It's about 16% of the budget for Medicaid. But this program expires on July 1, so right now state lawmakers, hospitals, lobbyists are really scrambling and trying to come up with a program that is new but is equitable, because the current system essentially has hospitals paying into this pool based on how full their beds were in 2005 and what their outpatient revenues looked like in 2009. And then they get money back based on those volumes. And a lot has changed across the state, across the country, in terms of the way that people are accessing Medicaid and just in terms of the demographic shift. Like in Chicago, have so many neighborhoods just empty out. So that's a huge debate right now. There's a public hearing in Springfield on Tuesday about this.
Sean Crawford, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Kristen Schorsch of Crane Chicago's Business, this week's guests on the Illinois Politics Roundtable. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Doesn't matter if you're looking back at 2017 or looking into the new year, big stories are everywhere.
The standard deduction nearly doubled.
Kim warned the U.S. that its mainland is within.
Allegations of sexual harassment and.
When you just need to get caught up and when you want to dig deep, count on Morning Edition for the latest updates and the background that slows the news down. Listen every day.
Here, Morning Edition, Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, serving the retirement needs of individuals with a continuum of care from independent and assisted living apartments to short and long-term skilled nursing care, all on the same comfortable campus. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Public Library hosts a performer whose greatest joy is entrancing audiences with timeless tales. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Storyteller Bobby Norfolk is appearing at Bloomington Public Library coming up Saturday, February 3rd at 11 a.m. Norfolk is an Emmy Award winner for the TV series Gator Tales. He began his career as a stand-up comedian before he transitioned to storytelling, combining his theater and stand-up background to become a story performer. Norfolk performs a variety of tales, but he specializes in the African-American experience, plus stories from Africa. Norfolk especially likes to share tales of the trickster known as Anansi the Spider.
A little bit of psychology here. Carl Jung, when he started breaking away from Sigmund Freud, started to study Eastern mysticism and metaphysics. And he started in looking into what's called archetypes.
Oh, yes.
And these are the hidden personalities that people have in their subconscious or unconscious minds. And one of those archetypes is the trickster. And in West African culture and storytelling, Anansi is the trickster.
Well, that reminds me of Loki from Norse mythology.
Yeah.
So we have all these archetypes really unite us.
Exactly, because no matter what religion or color, creed or place of origin, we are all united through our subconscious and unconscious minds. What I found is that the human brain is simply hardwired for storytelling.
Bobby, why are stories in the live oral tradition so important?
Because long before there was the printed page and the electronic media, that was a spoken word. A storyteller in ancient times usually would be around a fire, and the fire has a mystical, metaphysical effect on the mind. People who have fireplaces know this full well. Get lost in total thought, or light a couple of candles, a cup of hot tea, and it's over. And so the fire and the storyteller were usually outside, and then the backdrop was usually a grove of trees or a cliff wall. And so when the animated storyteller begins, what the audience sees is these caricatures and these sort of figures that are being superimposed on the grove of trees or the cliff wall and creating all these effects. Monsters, demons, ogres, giants, witches, the hero, the heroine, and so the imagination just takes over. And see, this is the danger that I have seen in a lot of reports about teenagers who are addicted to their handheld devices. They are losing the ability to imagine. And the human brain is, and the neuroscientists have warned us that these kids' brains are being rewired if we don't have some time out with that phone. And so now a lot of families are having put the phone away nights.
What do you find most rewarding about your work, Bobby?
To see an audience, young or old, get subjected to story hypnosis, and that is something that is not theory, it is a fact. When people are listening to a story well told, there's rapt silence, and I hear principals and teachers when I'm in front of 350 kids, no matter if it's pre-K through 12th grade, you can hear a pin drop in that room. You really have them in the palm of your hands. I am merely the messenger. It's the story well told that carries the hypnosis.
Well, Bobby, when you tell stories, are there particular character traits that you really like to focus on in your stories that you want to share with young people?
Yes, I do. Because when I started transcendental meditation and yoga, became vegetarian, I started taking my stories into that same realm of higher learning, I call it. And so the book, The Moral of the Story, Folktales for Character Development, all deal with character traits that we all have, i.e. teamwork and cooperation, responsibility, humanity, respect, acceptance. And so these character traits are inherent in all of my stories.
That storyteller, Bobby Norfolk. He's appearing at Bloomington Public Library Saturday, February 3rd at 11 a.m. and is the author of Eye to the Sky, Storytelling on the Edge of Magic. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In addition to performing stories for children, Bobby Norfolk has also has programs geared toward grown-ups that depict great Americans such as Scott Joplin. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. You can find Laura Kennedy's interviews and all of our stories at our website, WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your feedback at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.